Hello, I'm Libby Dodds-Ashley. I'm an antimicrobial stewardship pharmacist, and I currently work with the Duke Antimicrobial Stewardship Outreach Network. But for many years, I actually practiced up in New York and was based at the University of Rochester in Rochester, New York. With me today are two of my colleagues, Drs. Belinda Ostrowski and Priya Nori. We have a great show planned for you today, and we're going to talk about the growing threat of drug resistance. But first, let me introduce my colleagues. Dr. Ostrowski is a medical field officer with the Division of Healthcare Quality and Promotion at the CDC. She's currently embedded with the New York State Department of Health, where her work specifically focuses on antibiotic resistance and antimicrobial stewardship. Prior to joining the CDC for her current position, Belinda was based at Montefiore Medical Center and the Albert Einstein College of Medicine, where she was actively engaged in day-to-day stewardship activities and helped to build the program there. Priya Nori is currently the medical director of the stewardship program at Montefiore Health System, and she's also an associate program director of the ID training programs there. As the medical director of stewardship at Montefiore, Dr. Nori oversees operations at all of their facilities in terms of stewardship. She has extensive experience in this area and also has done research in the area of antibiotic resistance. So we have a great crew for you today to help talk to us about the importance of resistance as it relates to antimicrobial stewardship. So welcome, Priya and Belinda, and we'll go ahead and get started. One of the main reasons we engage in stewardship is to help us stem the tide of antibiotic resistance. And I think when we say that, many people tend to think about traditional resistance like MRSA. But what trends are you seeing and what should we be thinking about in terms of emerging drug resistance and what's on the horizon for our stewards?
Libby, that's a great question. So MRSA is traditionally the really scary pathogen that we have thought of for many decades. But now we're sort of in this post-MRSA era where we have to think about things that we didn't previously have to worry about so much. So these are things like drug-resistant salmonella, drug-resistant gonorrhea. And so these were traditionally infections in the community, and now they're becoming infections that we have to manage in our hospital systems because often they require IV antibiotics, very broad spectrum for many days. And so this is really something that we all have to have our radars up about, whether we're in the metropolitan New York area or upstate or really anywhere in New York, because we are sort of the port to the world, and patients can very seamlessly move throughout the state and carry around these pathogens with them, not just gonorrhea and other emerging drug-resistant infections, but the things that we have been grappling with for many years. So extensively drug-resistant gram-negative pathogens that we see often in the hospital. In that way, we're all connected because we all kind of share these bugs, and patients can very quickly take these with them wherever they happen to go within New York State.
Thank you, Priya. Belinda, what are you seeing from your vantage point?
Well, I think that it's just more and more challenging that, you know, that there are novel mechanisms of resistance that we're seeing that we might not have expected before. And just to sort of dovetail on what Priya is mentioning, I think a good example of that that the people in New York have sort of been challenged with is Candida auris, which is a resistant fungal infection. And I think that really has changed things in terms of the paradigm, because that isn't really what we would usually think of, that there would be a resistant fungal pathogen and that it would have the potential to even move through healthcare facilities. And so the challenges, particularly with this organism, is it has been seen sort of in parallel throughout the world in different continents. And particularly in the United States, it was introduced in New York, and now it's moved sort of through the continuum of care. And we are seeing it in several different types of healthcare facilities, including in hospitals, but also in long-term care facilities. And I think a few of the things that make it novel are, one, it's a little more resistant than other fungal pathogens, and so it makes it difficult potentially to treat that patient. It's novel in that it can be moved around because it often contaminates environmental surfaces, and so we are seeing clusters and outbreaks, which we normally wouldn't see necessarily with a fungal pathogen.
Thank you. Belinda, I know that Candida auris and other emerging resistant pathogens that we may not even know about yet are certainly on the concern list for many of our listeners. Can you describe to us the current efforts that are underway to help respond to these novel pathogens and threats?
Sure. So I think even we can sort of back off and say that, I mean, for many years, CDC has sort of been concerned about emerging pathogens, even if Candida auris wasn't on sort of the larger forefront in terms of the, you know, antibiotic threats in the United States sort of report in 2013 that many of our listeners might be familiar with. But at least I think it lays out four basic things that CDC thinks are important to sort of take a look at these pathogens. And if we back up, I think those four core actions have to do with making sure that we are preventing infections and the spread of resistance through, you know, important infection control efforts. Tracking antibiotic-resistant bacteria and other pathogens such as Candida auris, really doing what many of our listeners do frontline, which is making sure that we really are improving the use of our antimicrobials, especially antibiotics, but also antifungals, and then promoting the development of new antibiotics and developing diagnostic tests or at least algorithms for using those things. And that's sort of the higher picture. But then if you come down to the health department, I've been very fortunate to sort of have been embedded with the health department for about a year. And just to sort of back up and sort of explain what that kind of looks like from the perspective of the health department and how we interact with facilities is that, for example, preventing the spread and of infections and resistance, there's very detailed surveillance that's in place to try to identify any of these Candida auris isolates. And when a report comes through, either through a lab or through a provider, there's detailed information about the patients, tracking back where those patients may have been cared for. And then there's guidelines that have sort of been put together that explain the types of activities that are important to do at the facility, including the appropriate type of isolation and infection control that needs to be in place, the importance of environmental cleaning, some things about, potentially treatment of those patients. And then often it may be that there are more additional steps that are needed in terms of helping with control that may require coming out to facilities and really walking through the facility and trying to figure out what are the important steps to sort of put those things in place. They may be taken care of more by, let's say, the infection prevention partners to our listeners on the phone if they are more stewardship directed. But they would also include potentially helping out with what are called point prevalence, where if we identify, let's say, for Candida auris, one patient in a facility, often there may be unrecognized patients who have it, living on them, but it's not making them apparently sick, you know, those patients who are colonized. And so some of the efforts are to help with point prevalence surveys to identify these unrecognized patients. The other thing, the second part with tracking, is obviously taking a look at where we see these pathogens in different facilities and where it may be important to get extra educational material, et cetera, out. In terms of improving prescribing, you know, certainly the thing is that some of these patients, they just be colonized. They may not need antifungal drugs, and so preserving them for those patients who may go on from colonization to infection. And then last, I think that's very important for this is helping out with the development of diagnostic testing. And I know that one of the very important efforts that was made early on, even before I joined the team here, was the development of additional testing resources through the Wadsworth Referral Lab, which is the state lab in Albany. And it's really important for our listeners to know that if they thought that they had, let's say, a Candida auris or another novel type pathogen, that those isolates can be saved and sent to Wadsworth, and they have an additional battery of tests that can be available to make the confirmatory testing. For example, for Candida auris, they've developed a PCR platform that is very novel and can more in a timely fashion identify patients who may be colonized. They also do fungal susceptibility tests. For just backing up for other pathogens such as novel gram-negative resistance, there's a larger network called the Antimicrobial Resistance Laboratory Network. And Wadsworth happens to be one of those labs throughout the country that is able to help CDC in testing for novel gram-negative resistant mechanisms for organisms such as carbapenem-resistant Enterobacteriaceae.
Things are certainly is a lot going on, and it does often, I'm imagining, happen largely unknown to many frontline providers. Priya, what are you seeing on the front lines in terms of the clinical care side of patients and how we're responding to these growing threats? What has it changed
right.
for you?
So Belinda really nicely highlighted all the national and local public health efforts to conduct surveillance and specialized identification and molecular diagnostics. So as healthcare providers and hospital frontline staff, we are the direct beneficiaries of a lot of that work. So what that means is that if we happen to see a very ill patient with sepsis, with a lot of the things that we all care about as healthcare providers in terms of maximizing outcomes for that patient, preventing death, preventing spread of infection to other patients, there are certain clues that we can convey to the health department. We can, we've established a channel of communication over the past number of years. It's very streamlined now where we can virtually call them about anything and say, I feel this patient may have this particular pathogen because of, let's say, a funny susceptibility profile we see from our own clinical laboratory. We can alert them to something that's strange that's going on. Before, I think I alluded to infections in travelers. So if we happen to know that somebody came from a part of the world where there's a lot of conflict, there's a lot of drug resistance, there's poor infrastructure, and now they're here being cared for in our hospital and they're very sick with a potentially multi-drug resistant pathogen, before we even have all that information back, we can raise the flags and communicate with our public health partners and say, I need your help with this one because I really think this might be a case of X drug-resistant pathogen, I need your help to perform that specialized testing or link it with other cases throughout the region and help to curb a potential outbreak within our hospital system. And I think over this series of the past few years, due to the emergence of these pathogens, we've developed a very nice system of communication from the very local to the national level. Belinda, I think you would agree. And so Candida auris is a beautiful example of that. Our clinical lab basically detects a very funny pattern of resistance in the clinical isolates. And so they directly communicate with their public health partners through the laboratory, through the reporting network that Belinda described. And then we as clinicians do the same through our liaisons, such as Belinda or others in the network of the public health system, to make sure that we correctly identify, correctly manage and treat and contain and then prevent spread of that pathogen within our walls, and then also make sure that on transitions of care that we also continue to survey and track and make sure that wherever those patients happen to go next, they're not spreading these pathogens around to the next place and the next place. And really, this is for the benefit of all, every citizen, but especially those patients, their families, their communities. And it's a very, while it's a very large, intricate system of communication, it's very patient-centered at the same time where we have the best interests of every patient, every person in the hospital in mind.
So I couldn't agree more. I mean, I think actually Priya brought up something very, very important, which is you could think that there's this large system out there, okay, everything's covered, this is, you know, larger public health and the CDC, they've got it covered. And they obviously we have our elements, but it doesn't take the place of an astute clinician or an astute stewardship pharmacist or infection control practitioner, et cetera, is that often to find the first of something that would be that index, it may be that somebody just notes something that looks a little funny, and that backing up and having your lab really take a look and tell us about those things, that is really, really important, because you are the first guard, basically, to detect something, you know, very early.
I couldn't agree more, Belinda. I think that one of the important lessons learned over time with certain public health emergencies, starting with probably SARS and then Ebola and then building on that, was that we really strengthened those partnerships between local healthcare facilities and public health. And so each time there's a potential new situation or emerging pathogen, we're all over it. And we have very swift ways of very effective communication back and forth. And well, recently there was a really nice paper in the New England Journal, I believe, that kind of highlighted really all the successes of this concerted effort between public health and hospital systems about curbing the prevalence of healthcare-associated conditions over the course of many years. And so some conditions, the prevalence of them dropped considerably, and others at least have remained static. And that clearly reflects a well-coordinated system and also local efforts to improve environmental handling and cleaning and stewardship, intensified efforts, and more emphasis on infection control and resources dedicated to all these specific areas. So there's actually proof that this is working.
Specifically, I think that there is more guidance now about if we were to see a more novel mechanism, there's a tiered approach that CDC is discussing that sort of works with public health to decide. It's tiers 1, 2, and 3, and basically describes, based on if something is really totally novel, if something is more novel to the area, but we know somewhat about the resistant mechanism. And then the third tier has to do with pathogens that we see on a more regular basis, but that are still somewhat problematic, and sort of detailing out the types of activities that would be appropriate to do for those patients, including maybe not just at your facility, but we may track back to where those patients have been and look to screen, let's say, roommates, et cetera.
Thank you both. You know, I think you've done a great job of describing some resources that are available. Those are very important to the listeners. And there are lots of resources available as well through Haney's. Just as a reminder, participants in the Stewardship Collaborative not only have access to current resources that are available on the Haney's website at Haney's, H-A-N-Y-S.org, but also have the ability to do direct one-on-one consultation with consultants with Haney's, who are stewardship experts and available to give one-on-one individualized consultation to help what might be happening at your facility. I did, in the setting of antibiotic resistance, wanted to ask both of you. So this is something that you've nicely described, and it's nice to hear some positive effects of, you know, decades of work on infection prevention and epidemiology that really were sort of doubled down on efforts from the federal and state level back around 2015, and it's nice to finally to hear the positive effects of all that work. But I'm wondering, you know, where do you think we have opportunities to improve in terms of antibiotic resistance? What could people be doing? You know, we may have listeners who are at smaller facilities that may not see a lot of international travelers or necessarily be so concerned or have seen some of these more severe gram-negative resistant pathogens yet, but we know the possibility is always there. So what are things that we could do better, or what are things that we should be sure we are doing to help protect our patients from getting infections with the organisms that we are seeing today?
It's really a societal responsibility, I think, and we need to kind of bring it to the people, I guess, to put it simply, to have them be stakeholders in their own health as pertains to drug-resistant infections. These are important questions that all patients should be asking their doctors. Do I really need these antibiotics? Well, what's the shortest duration I can take them for? What side effects should I expect? Is it really worth it? Is there something else I can take instead? Please only give me antibiotics when I really need them. And for those conditions in the gray zone, perhaps I should try something else. I think we can do a better job of having that conversation and helping other people to see it kind of from our lens, which is that while some conditions really need antibiotic treatment and those should not be spared to save lives and treatable conditions, for a lot of other conditions, antibiotics are not the answer. And I think we need to all be on the same. Our messaging has to be really clear on that and enhanced, I believe.
Thank you, Priya. Belinda, what are your thoughts?
So I think Priya brings up all fantastic points. I think one thing is that even if you think you might not have resistance right now, you need to really have your antennas up and that you need to be astute. I think Priya brings up some excellent points. And I think one of the things is even if we don't think we have resistance, it may really be there and we're unaware. And so being an astute clinician is very, very important. It seems that every few years we're just challenged with something else. And the thing is that, you know, even though some of these may be concerning that, you know, it's the flavor du jour to have Candida auris or, you know, one of the novel CRE mechanisms, I think what it does is it has us back up and set a light on something that, you know, just the basics that are really, really important, is that many of the things that are going to work for controlling these pathogens are going to work also for the next one down the road.
Great, thank you. And I'll challenge you with one more question. What do you think is the biggest thing that our frontline clinicians, our nurses, our pharmacists can be doing and looking for to help us with antibiotic resistance? If there's one thing that you could ask everybody to do today to help improve on this or learn more about it or be more astute, what would that be?
I think hand hygiene is king. Of course, I think that we've known for many years that's probably the simplest thing that we could all do as healthcare providers, as everyday citizens. But taking it a step further, I think going back to something I said earlier, which is, do I really need this antibiotic? Does the patient really need this antibiotic? And if so, when is the first available moment that we can think about either dialing that down to something less broad spectrum or even stopping? I think that that would tremendously benefit that particular patient and then even potentially the next and the next and the next downstream.
That's great. And Belinda, from your vantage point, what one change would you make if I could wave my magic wand for you?
Oh, that's hard. I do agree with Priya that globally attacking the prescribing is really, really important. But I think probably that one of the biggest pitfalls that I see is that we don't always think to have the relationships to communicate all the things that we're concerned about, knowing the resources that are outside of your walls that really, you know, that we're a larger global team on this effort.
Great. I want to thank you both. This has been fantastic information for the listeners as they work to combat and prevent antibiotic resistance in their own facilities. We want to thank everyone for listening, and we also want to encourage you to listen to the other episodes in the series, which include an episode on long-term care facility stewardship, as well as one with updates on acute care stewardship that features guests from the CDC, as well as the New York State Department of Health. We also, again, want to remind everyone that you are able to seek additional resources at that Haney's website, HANYS.org, where you can find lots of good resources and more is to come. So keep checking back as new tools are being developed and rolled out all the time to try to help you with your stewardship and resistance fighting efforts. So with that, we'll close for today. And again, thanks, everyone. Thanks, Belinda and Priya. This was great.
Libby, thank you so much. This was a ton of fun.